people will actually be happier if they don't have a lot of choices they can waffle between, make a choice and we're going to move forward. That can actually be better, especially if they never knew that they could have had an option. That's just how the class is. You pick one and it goes this way. You didn't even know that that could have been an option. And we make decisions like this in the way we present information all the time, whether we think about it or not. So that it's always better to be thoughtful about these sorts of things, because every little thing can have a really big impact.
Welcome to the Simple Brand Podcast, the show dedicated to helping you create simple experiences for your customers and for your team members. Each week, we're bringing you amazing interviews with business leaders and authors who will teach you how to differentiate your business with the one thing your customers need the most, simplicity. Your customers live in a complex world. Let's make it simple. Now, here's your host, Matt Lyles.
Helping you create loyal customers and loyal employees all through the power of simplicity. This is the Simple Brand Podcast, now heard around the world, including St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm your host, Matt Lyles, and this week I'm talking with Melina Palmer. Melina's the CEO of The Brainy Business, where she provides behavioral economics training and consulting to businesses all around the world. She hosts a podcast devoted to behavioral economics, The Brainy Business, Understanding the Psychology of Why People Buy. And Melina's the best-selling author of two books devoted to behavioral economics, including her latest, What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You. Hey, that book comes out this week. Melina and I discuss her lessons from What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You, and these lessons help you better understand how the human brain works and how the human brain adapts to change, but more importantly, how your employees adapt to change. And we talk through her roadmap that helps you reduce any of that friction that comes up when it comes to instilling organizational change and help you ensure that you can get your employees on board with any change in the simplest way possible. So here it is. Here's my interview with Melina Palmer. Hi, Melina. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about this. Congrats on releasing What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You.
Thank you. I'm really excited. Any book is exciting. And as I was finishing this one up, knew it was a big one that I'm excited to have out in the world. So thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. And it hasn't been that much time between this one and your previous book.
Yes. So I think actually it's 17 months to the day. So the first book came out May 11th, 2021. Second is October 11th, 2022. So just cranking them out and have plans for the third in the series already. So we'll see.
Oh my goodness. And I can't wait for the third one to come out. What, in another 17 months?
We'll see. Yeah.
Well, all right. So this ties into your background in behavioral economics. So before we talk about what your employees need, I want to get an introduction on behavioral economics. How do you define that?
So really, it is the psychology of why people buy would be the easy kind of first step in there. That's the tagline of my podcast, The Brainy Business. And taking that a step further would be in traditional economics, let's say if traditional economics and psychology had a baby, we'd have behavioral economics. Traditional economics assumes logical people making rational choices in everything that they do, not really the world we live in. So by incorporating psychology and neuroscience, being able to really understand the brain, how people actually make decisions instead of what we all think people should do, gives us this window into better communication and being able to have more brain-friendly messaging, which is what I help people to do.
Nice. And so it sounds like that same study also ties into how our people, how our employees think and act and make decisions?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have kind of expanded from just the psychology of why people buy to say the psychology of why people act, choose, change, and buy is kind of how I'm encompassing this all now. And the reason that it ties in in my opinion, because we've got behavioral science, behavioral economics, and there's a lot of overlap, but really, if you're trying to get someone to change anything that they're doing, you need them to buy in on whatever idea you're selling them, even if there isn't any money exchanging hands, right? So you still need that kind of back and forth in the same way that you would in presenting information. So I actually use the same framework for change as I do for pricing strategy.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And like a change needs to happen and you have to have somebody to buy into that change and actually want to go along with that change. And then depending on the level of that change, you know, if it's a small transaction, okay, maybe not a big deal. The larger and larger that the change is, the harder and harder that it is to implement that and to get people to buy into that. So why is that so hard for leaders to instill and implement change in their organizations?
So one thing is kind of what you were talking about there, that we are focused on change and just thinking about the big stuff, right? To say a change is a merger or a rebrand or a succession planning or whatever, some big thing that everyone has to get on board for that we've decided there's an initiative for. Like now we have a big change, so this is what we're going to focus on. And all the little stuff we like to say doesn't really matter, right? We think that's not going to add up. That's not a big deal. Those small changes, we don't really put much stock in, but the brain doesn't look at it in that way. So to take a step back, let's talk about our brains and how they really work in making decisions. So we'll start by asking about decisions themselves. Listener can be, you know, asking themselves here, how many decisions do you think you make in an average day? Whether it's today, it was yesterday. Do you have a guess? I don't know if you've...
Oh my goodness. I mean, if I had to really think about it and like also include those decisions that feel like it's just part of the normal flow and habits. I mean, it could be thousands, right?
Yeah. So people, if you think about the decisions you make, you might say 50 or 100, or maybe you jump in and go crazy and say 5,000, right? I make 5,000 decisions. Science shows that everybody makes an average of 35,000 decisions every single day.
35,000. Wow.
Yes, remotely conscious decisions. So yes, it's in the thousands, and it's probably still more thousands than you expected me to say, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of decisions that we are making. And so clearly that all can't be done on this conscious level, right? We need subconscious processing. And the brain is kind of set up in that way that we have this subconscious filter that's kind of a gatekeeper and trying to maintain as much as it can because it's faster automatic processing. It can only do that using rules of thumb and predictability of things that have worked well in the past. And it wants to hold on to as much as it possibly can because the conscious brain is slower. Don't want to wait for that. I got a plan, right? I'm ready to go. Go, 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 go. So in that, one of my favorite analogies is one from a psychologist at NYU talking about your brain as a person riding an elephant. So if you imagine you have your logical, conscious rider that has a plan, knows where we're going, where we're going to get to, and it can see out onto the horizon. But the elephant maybe wants to go in a different direction or it wants to sit down. You can't push or pull or logic it into going where you want. And so you have to properly motivate the elephant to go in the right direction. And so with behavioral economics, it's understanding the rules that the elephant is using to make decisions to help properly motivate that. And so those micro decisions of those 35,000, I talk about it like snowflakes, like accumulating in your path, right? So every conversation really is a change conversation. And those small things can add up and either be working for you to be building momentum or like a tundra of nightmares to make it. Yeah. So even the big or small changes can be incredibly difficult if you're not thoughtful about it throughout the whole process.
Well, and I think you alluded to this as well. If I'm the one that's trying to calm this elephant, to drive this elephant, I can't think about and I can't try and convince it with the things that motivate me.
Right.
I've got to focus on what motivates the elephant, not myself.
Right. And when we sit down and we're doing stuff in our businesses, whether we're thinking about communicating with members of the team or with customers, creating new products or setting up pricing strategy, whatever it is, we, the writer, think we're communicating to other writers, even though when we buy, our elephant is doing all that processing, right? We just don't realize it because they don't really speak the same language. And our brains like to think that they're better, faster, stronger, smarter than everybody else, including the us of 5 minutes ago, right? So we really want to be thinking we are in charge. And so you can't even, you know, looking at that, we don't know why we do things. So we can't ask somebody why they made a choice or what they're going to do. That's why my books are and can't tell you, right? What your customer wants and can't tell you, what your employees need and can't tell you, is because we're not fully in tuned into the decisions that our brains are making on that subconscious level. But understanding the rules that are commonly used as proven by science, we can help to communicate in a way that's going to make it someone is more likely to naturally adapt to change or to buy a product or whatever that happens to be.
So then how can we, as leaders who are driving the change and introducing the change, how can we find out what it is that does drive and motivate our employees?
So hopefully not the worst thing to say ever is you can read my book. Well, it's a good step there, right? But really is being able to understand bias, and starting with bias is a great place to start. Another thing that businesses kind of get wrong is by looking for ways to eliminate bias. It's not uncommon for a company to say, we're going to completely eliminate bias from what we do. We're going to take it out of our company. But it's not possible.
Right. I mean, everyone has some bias, right?
Right. Well, all of the brain's decision making on that subconscious level, I'm talking about using those rules of thumb and predictability, status quo, those are biases. That is how the brain makes decisions. And so instead of trying to eliminate it, which is not something that is really possible to do, it would be to reframe and look at that in a different way and see where you want to be working with biases that already exist to help encourage, and when you need to kind of sidestep and know something may be a problem, and when you can be leveraging something to help make change easier. So I'm going to use an example of a company called The Littery, which is an organization that has decided to tackle helping people to properly throw away and sort their garbage every time in everything that they do. And if I told you this was your new job and you couldn't do anything until you got everyone in the world to properly throw away and sort their garbage, probably feels like you're never going to be doing anything else, and your children's children's children are going to be taking this on, right? Because
yeah, good luck.
Yeah. And if you were, though, to sit down and say, okay, this is my task, what am I going to do? You may think people just don't know what is compost versus recycling. They aren't aware of where things need to go. So we need a video explaining it. We need a brochure, or they don't understand the problem of Garbage Island, or we need to show more turtles with straws in their noses, because if they understood this, if they were as passionate, they would make the change.
Yeah. It's about having them have the knowledge of it, right?
Yes. But it's not, right? This is what has been tried for decades now, that people have been trying to do this and beyond, right? And in all change. So change is hard when you're trying to force into logic that doesn't already fit. So, and trying to make it so people care about something in the same way that you do, or how you think they should care about something. So if instead you take a step back and say, really, we just need the thing to get into the recycling or the compost or whatever it is. We just need people to change that behavior, and them caring about why is secondarily important. It's not the most important thing. And that's a surprisingly difficult thing to separate ourselves from when we're looking at trying to change behavior. But taking that step back, making that change, and then finding a way you can motivate. In this case, the Littery turns litter into lottery tickets. So they have created smart garbage cans, that when you throw something away and your phone is in proximity to that can, it can tell that you put a bottle into the recycling and it will give you a notification and say, hey, great job, Melina. You've been entered into the lottery. And if you throw away a rock or something, it'll say, nice try. That belongs in nature. You don't get anything. Or if you put the bottle in the trash, it'll say, thanks for throwing that away. Next time that goes here and you'll get entered in. So they tested in movie theaters, which if you haven't been to a movie theater in a while, perhaps you've forgotten. It's one of the grossest places of public, right? That people forget, even if they have really good decorum when it comes to anywhere else, just sort of leave everything around and expect it's someone else's job to throw right. that away for you.
Yeah.
So they tested at 4 different movie theaters in Sweden and over 30 days. And having people just with very simple messaging saying, hey, if you throw this away, you'll be entered into a lottery. Good job. And they had 100% compliance across the 4 theaters, 30 days.
Wow.
Everyone knew what to do. Nobody had to ask.
Right.
They just needed to be properly motivated, and change magically became easy, right? And in that case, the prize was only 5,000 euro, which is still like, okay, I put the popcorn bucket in the bin and I could win 5,000 bucks, euros, whatever. That's motivating for me, right? So now when you walk down the street, if you see a bottle sitting there, you think, ugh, some people are so disgusting, and just keep walking by and think about how great you are, and you wouldn't do that, but you don't feel motivated to pick it up. If you see it in, and you are, you know, a member of this lottery program, you see, hey, I could win $1 million. I'm going to throw that thing away and like, hooray for me. I'm going to drop that in the recycling bin. So properly motivating, working with the rules of the brain that already exist can make it so change is actually incredibly easy. We change all the time when we're properly motivated. And so that's just a way to start to look at the problem in a different way can help you to get people further down that path.
Yeah, there you go. Looking at it from a different way, tapping into, you know, something else that people care about.
Yeah, I say all the time, really easy to find the right answer to the wrong question. And for any business, investing more time up front in making sure that you are working on and looking at the right problem is going to pay off much more than just jumping in. Again, because our brains like to think that we're smarter than everyone else, we're less biased, we're easier and more adaptable and all the things, you may right. jump in to, oh, this is the problem. Boop. And then you're working on the solution immediately. But even a slightly different question can get you to a very different place. A common example here being asking what is 5 plus 5 is not the same as asking how many ways can we make 10? And you'll get to 2 very different places by right. asking the question a little bit differently.
Oh, wow. So you spend some time in the book writing about how you being the one introducing and driving the change. You are the most important factor in helping others to buy into and go along with the change. So can you explain that?
Yeah, I have 2 chapters that close out part 1. It says, change is all about you, is the first one. And the next one, and it's dot, 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 right? And then the next one starts dot, 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 and it has nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
So in that way, when we think about how people react to change, the way we're presenting it is very important, right? It's about how change is presented to them. Thinking about that literary example, right? If we take more time to be more thoughtful in the way that we're presenting information, understanding that bias, knowing how we're biased, how the other person is biased, how we can make that an easier process, what do we actually need to happen? How can we be more open in this situation? All these sorts of things. That's very important. And you can make those same micro decisions, micro shifts. It doesn't have to be these big sweeping things. And I have micro shift moments throughout the book, so you can have little wins along the way. So that's the first piece. It's all about you and the way you present information. And in the, it has nothing to do with you. You have to be aware of how those other people are biased and looking to be receiving information and making it about them. You know, we have the golden rule that used to be in place, right? To treat people how you want to be treated. The platinum rule, treat people how they want to be treated. The problem is people don't know how they want to be treated or how they will react or what they're going to like or what's going to be in their best interest. What they think they'll want is often not what they actually want at the end of the day. And so having this awareness of behavioral economics and some of these rules, you know, can be helpful. I give an example in the book just to show another kind of one of these of a study that was done at Harvard. That they had students take a photography class. So they had two photos that were like their best ones at the end of the class. And in one group, you were told that you pick your photo and the other one is going to be kept, you know, in reserve here. And you can change your mind at any time, you know, to have the other one if you want. But which one do you want to take? And we'll have the other one here. You can always change your mind and get the other. The other group was told, pick one and immediately this thing is getting on a plane and being shipped overseas. You will never be able to reverse your decision. Choose wisely. Pick right, the one that you want. Which group do you feel like you would want to be in?
I would want to be in the first group, like having that choice, right?
Everyone says that.
So. Yeah.
And the people who were in the first group who did that, have that option, felt more remorseful, more angst, liked their photos less than those who were in the second group. And so we're really good at rationalizing why what we have is the best thing when we don't have an option to change it. But this paradox of choice, this overwhelm that comes from always being able to change our minds, to look more, to analyze, adds a lot of stress in a way that can make us be less satisfied with what it is that we have. So really presenting lots of choices and options can make it worse. And where everyone would say, and people then they ask, you know, which class would you like to enroll in? People say they would rather be in the first one. They think they would be happier in that path, but they're not. Wow. People are actually happier in the other option. And so in this way, if you understand that, and then some questions you don't ask because you know based on the science that people will actually be happier if they don't have a lot of choices they can waffle between, and we say, you know, make a choice and we're going to move forward, that can actually be better, especially if they never knew that they could have had an option. That's just how the class is. You pick one and it goes this way. You didn't even know that that could have been an option, right? So it's not like it weighs on you of something you weren't presented with. And we make decisions like this in the way we present information all the time, whether we think about it or not. So I recommend that it's always better to be thoughtful about these sorts of things because every little thing can have a really big impact.
Wow. So I think about a lot of the changes that I've been a part of in my career, changes that were either announced and pushed down on me, or changes that I got to be a part of, like to help create and announce and deliver. And I think a lot of times it seems like those of us who are in charge of leading and driving this change, we spend a lot of time on crafting the change itself, and probably not enough time on figuring out the right way to announce it, to get people's buy-in.
Yes. That's where you spend months or sometimes even years working on this change behind the scenes. And then, you know, tell everyone is a task on a very long to-do list that just kind of is, oh, we're just going to tell them, right? Ta-da. And then we can say we did it. But the way, again, you present that information is very important. So one really badly communicated message can unravel everything, and you don't even realize that that's where things went wrong. The change itself may have been great. It's not necessarily that that's the problem, but how it was presented to people. Another example to think of, and we've all kind of been in this situation, right? So imagine the manager walks in, they're kind of head in their hands, rubbing their face a little bit and say, hey, everybody, gather around. I got to tell you something. I know you're not going to like it, but you know, I just heard from the folks upstairs. We're going to have to change over to this new system. I know we've got a lot going on right now, but I'm going to need everybody to just get on board with this. I need you to get on the train. We're moving forward. You know, I know you don't like it, but too bad, right? Don't shoot the messenger, right? Yikes. We have primed everyone to think this is terrible and something really bad. And even people who might have been excited are kind of thinking, like, I guess this is a bad thing. Everyone else doesn't like this idea, so I shouldn't either. We are a herding species. And so when we see what others like us are doing, especially in an area that is unpredictable to us or that we haven't been in before, we very much look to others like us to see how we should act. So in that case, when you say, I know you're not going to like this, like, oh, I guess everyone else doesn't. I shouldn't like this either, right? If instead that message was presented in a way where that manager was to know, hey, this isn't about me. This is about everyone else. And also they're saying like, I need you to get on the team. I need you to know this. It's not, don't blame me, me, me. It's all about them, right? So if instead, if they were to come in and say, hey, everybody, I've heard from many of you throughout the years that the system we currently use is one that you don't really enjoy, that it can be slow, that it's cumbersome, it's difficult to work through, and it is too many steps to get to the information that you want. We've heard you, and the company is working on creating this new system that's going to be able to implement everything you've been asking for. We have 30 days to find the people on our team who are going to be able to give feedback, be part of creating this new system to make it the best for everyone. If you are interested, please let me know and we can move forward. Very excited about the new system and how it can help us all to have an easier time doing our jobs and serving our customers. Ta-da, right?
All right, yeah, okay.
Same thing, same exact change, right? And you can say, oh, I get to be part of that. That's called the IKEA effect. We like things that we're part of. It was framed in a different way that we feel better about, and everyone is having a chance to be part of it if they so choose, but they don't have to, right? So just feels better. I had an opportunity to be included. It's my choice if I don't want to be. All of these aspects. And again, it could be the exact same new system, the exact same change initiative, one team feeling much better about it than the other based on the way that it was presented to them.
Right. And there's a couple of things there. One is how it's communicated. You know, two, you know, recognizing how people are currently feeling before the change. You know, there's been some concerns about the current system, you know, and we're looking to change that. And then three, here's your opportunity for you to be a part of the solution. You've got the opportunity to provide feedback. And now people may recognize and know, okay, I mean, like 100% of our feedback may not be implemented, but we know that they're at least listening to us.
Yeah. And along those lines, it's important to note, if the thing is so far gone that you will not be taking any of their thoughts, do not ask. Don't do that.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that many great companies and people have done over time, right? Where you say, well, and then we'll just go ahead and ask. And nobody stops and says, well, like, can we even change these things if people say that it sucks or they hate it? No, like maybe we present it in a different way, right? That's the same as the photos at the end of the class, right? You want to look at what the opportunities and options even are and then determine the best way to present that information. Ideally, yes, you can start further back in any process and let people be involved where they can be, but not everybody can be involved in every choice, and people know that. But finding even little moments of transparency and authenticity, I use this, the concept in behavioral science is reciprocity, that when we give a little, people feel compelled to give back. Right. So in the case of change, so if we're looking at selling goods or services, that would be like a free sample or podcasts that are available for free or anything, a lead magnet, right? Something that you give out. In the case of change, I look at this as trust, transparency, authenticity, giving them advance notice and kindness and openness is how you can be giving a little bit of something that people know you don't have to do that makes them feel more compelled to give back. But that doesn't necessarily work if you don't bring attention to it. So I've been listening to you. I've heard what you've said over the years. I pay attention. You're important to me. That's communicated in that messaging that makes people think, oh, well, that's nice that you think about me. I want to give a little something back, right? But if you don't say that, even if their input came into play, then they don't know and they didn't hear it at the right time to be able to have that be part of that whole change process.
Yeah. Even if there's not the opportunity or the ability for them to be part of crafting and creating the change going forward, at least help them understand and feel like they've been part of it already.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's so I created this imaginary example, right, which has a few important steps in it to show kind of a dream case of how this can work. But if you don't have the last option of working together in the next step, there's still a way that you can be properly communicating the value of the thing to be able to help that be a good change process.
Right. Absolutely.
Did you know that in addition to my podcast and my articles, I speak to audiences all over to help them simplify their customer experience and simplify their employee experience? I've spent the last few years leading a crusade of simplicity across the globe. If you want a winning brand, you have to provide a simple experience to your customers and to your team members. Whether it's a live event or a virtual event, I'd love to partner with you and teach your audience how to do just that. With over a decade in marketing, I know how to hook and captivate an audience. And as a speaker, I know how to connect with that audience. Along with my lessons, I use stories and humor to keep everyone engaged and inspired. Then they leave with the knowledge and next steps to transform their business. As an event planner, you're managing lots of details to give your audience the most memorable event. The last thing you need is a speaker who will make your event memorable for all the wrong reasons. Not only will I leave your audience energized and inspired, I'll make it easy for your team to work with me. Hey, if I've built my brand around simplicity, then you know I'm going to make it simple for you. When you visit mattlyles.com/speaking, you'll find everything you need to know, including details on my topics, promotional materials, and most importantly, a link to connect with my team so we can book your event. So visit mattlyles.com/speaking. I can't wait to help your audience brand out from the crowd.
Sometimes, you know, depending on what that change is, I mean, like it may be something that is so big and may also be like quite confidential as well. Like, well, we can't tell people until this certain time. Well, if it is that big, you know, depending on your company, there are people that you can bring in at certain points. And it's taking that time and being thoughtful about, okay, who exactly can we bring in and at what point can we bring them in? And then like, let's try to bring them in at that point. And then when things are announced, you know, hey, just wanted to let you know, as you're announcing this, this person who's part of your organization or this person who you're connecting to has been acting on your behalf to help create this.
Yeah. And so an important thing to note there, as far as this awareness of the biases that exist and being able to change your own approach to things. So when you know something and no one else knows the thing, it feels very uncomfortable. You have almost like a guilt about it where it's weighing on you. You have a focusing illusion problem, and that we're really looking at the thing. And we also have a confirmation bias that makes it so all the input that our brain is getting is making us think that they must know the secret. And so we feel like we have to then, we let someone in that maybe we weren't supposed to, but we say they knew, they could tell, and they were asking these questions that made it so obvious. But it's like you were being weird. And so they asked if you were weird. And then and you say, oh my gosh, I'm not supposed to tell you, but right. Cause you're just like aching to say the thing. So just a little, you know, step back and talking about, you know, we talked about those 35,000 decisions people make every day. And I talked about the conscious and the subconscious to talk a little bit about the processing power of our brains. Your subconscious can process about 11 million bits of information per second. 11 million bits per second, churning through a lot. Yeah. Yes. The conscious brain can do about 40, not 40,000, not 400,000, which would still be a really bad ratio, just 40, right? So if we think about this in a different way, and were to say, for every one piece of information that your subconscious brain let through the filter that got to the conscious brain, 275,000 other things were not important enough to make it through your filter. So you're focusing on some stuff where you think, say, just to take a little sidestep on our experience we're talking about here, imagine you think your manager hates you, right? They hate me. They never give me any opportunities. You go in for a meeting and you're watching them and you're looking for things. You're focusing in on stuff that will confirm how you feel about them and what that says about you in your role, right? Oh, they're looking at me instead of somebody else. Oh, I must have said something dumb. I know that he or she or they hate me. Like, they're thinking this thing. Oh, I'll just stop talking. I never get a chance to talk, right? That's all this internal conversation in your own mind. Someone who believes that their manager sees value in them, likes the input they're giving, would have that same look and say, oh, they're looking at me. They think that I am giving a good point. They must be on board with this. I'm excited. Let's keep talking because clearly this is valuable. Again, all the same things, but we focused on it in a way that all repeated itself. Do you remember there was that it was like a Tide commercial, I think, for like the Tide stain stick, where the person's in the job interview and the shirt has a stain that's talking.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, right? Where you feel like all they're looking at is the stain on your shirt and you're so aware. But when you didn't know you had a stain on your shirt, you weren't aware and like focused on it in the same way, right?
Right, right.
So one, you can choose to focus on something else. So even if you have someone who you know is really difficult on your team, you go, oh, okay, everybody's going to be good, but I have to tell Melina about this thing and she's the worst, right? She's always asking questions and is so difficult in this process. And you're going into the meeting that way. How am I going to convince her that she's wrong and just get her on board? I'm going in thinking, ugh, my manager hates me. This is going to be, they never listen to what I have to say. You know, there's this whole problem. If you instead go in being more open to saying, you know, Melina asks questions, maybe because she cares about the team. How can I be listening to what it is that she's thinking or saying, be more open, genuinely curious. How might that change the situation? You know, you can end up in a very different place.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. It's like Ted Lasso says, you know, be curious, not judgmental.
Oh, Ted Lasso. I have a Roy Kent paraphrased paragraph. I, of course, had to paraphrase because Roy Kent swears a lot and I didn't have a lot of F words in the book, but most people are fine and you shouldn't have to settle for fine. And, you know, using it to how you look at your role and your job and your work, and you can make it better if you choose to focus on different things. Right?
That's it. All right. Well, you've developed a framework that helps leaders understand how to deliver the change. And we've actually touched on a couple of these just in talking, but it's not about the cookie framework.
Yes.
Can you walk through that?
Sure. So in this, like I said, this is the same framework I use for pricing as for change.
Yeah.
So if you imagine we're walking down the street having a great conversation about change or something, and we're very excited about it. But then all of a sudden, there's this delicious scent that wafts toward us. It's sweet and a little bit salty, and there's this chocolate undertone to it. We realize that's cookies baking, right?
Yeah.
Go, we're still talking, but we're a little bit more distracted. We're like cartoon characters with our noses pulling us down the street to try and find where this is, right?
I love that image.
Yeah. We get in front of the store. We see a line of people waiting. We get into line as well, and we're given a free sample. And they say, oh, today only, buy three, get one free. Before we know it, we walk out of the store eating cookies and each with a bag in hand for later. So that's scenario one. Scenario two, walking down the street, same conversation. Someone comes up and shoves a coupon in our face and says, hey, today only, I've got this these cookies. And if you buy four of them, you only have to pay for three. I've got samples. You go, ugh, die, get out of here, right? We were having a conversation. How rude are you? Now we're having a conversation about how bad sales experiences. And then we see the store and the line, and we're pitying those people with worse standards than us. And we're getting their names so we can write a Yelp review about how bad their business practices are. And by the time we smell the cookies, we just hate them, right? So in the two scenarios, all the same things happened, but in a different order. And in the first scenario, we know here, right, it wasn't about price. It's not about the cookie. It's not about the price of the cookie. The first scenario, they could have been $3 each, and they could have been 25 cents in the second scenario. And we were definitely buying, unless they were like $100 or something crazy in the first one. And we were definitely not buying, no matter how affordable they were, because of how that information was presented to us. And like I said, it was all the same stuff, but you have to start with the scent of the cookies, which is our priming. We have the way that things were framed in a different way. It's a little subtle thing, but where we had the buy three, get one free versus, oh, if you pay buy four cookies, you only pay for three of them, feels a lot more clunky in the way that's delivered. The second one,
I was thinking, wait, what? I know. I don't even want to do math today.
Right, right. And when I say these, I think people think that I just forgot how to say it, but it is very intentional in the story that I'm saying it in a weird, awkward way, right? And another example of that being if I said, oh, in a particular month after there's been a lot of precipitation, you know, we're likely to have more flora that will pop up because of what happened in the preceding month. You say, what? Like, versus April showers bring May flowers, like, ta-da, right? That makes sense. And I sound so much smarter than when I had this long, drolling, random thing that I said. So taking the time to think about something, and actually when it rhymes, we think people are more thoughtful and intelligent and believe things more. It doesn't make it any more true. That's one of those rules that our brains have. We also had scarcity, reciprocity, herding, and social proof, all that were part of that little tiny cookie experience. Right. And so that framework and how to understand those concepts and how to implement them is really what is the basis of the book.
Well, and that goes back to what we've been talking about, is that it takes a lot of time, a lot of thought, and a lot of intentionality into crafting each of those pieces of the framework. You know, it takes a lot more time to figure out the right way to say, buy three, get one free, than saying the other thing you said that I can't even remember.
Yeah. Yeah. If you get four cookies, you only have to pay for three of them. Right. That's the, you know, Mark Twain, and I'm sure others have said the, you know, I'm sorry, this letter's so long, I didn't have time to write a shorter one. But putting in the time up front can help to reduce the workload that everyone has and make it so then our brains are more likely to be receptive to change. So research has found that 50% of emails that we send, people misunderstand what you're saying. Half the time, people don't know what you're saying to them. And then there's all this follow-up. It's not just that the message was confusing, but that there's some level of follow-up like, hey, can we meet? Is different than, and then someone has to say, maybe, like, do you want half an hour or do you need an hour? Like, what are we talking about? Is it urgent? And, you know, then there's all this back and forth and somebody says, well, I'll send you a Slack message and then you respond to me via an email. And then it's like on and on of all this extra communication that's not helpful, but creates a lot of extra stress on the brain, which makes us less creative. And we have worse decisions. We're more likely to rely on that status quo. And that means we're going to be less likely to be receptive to change because our brain is bogged down with all this extra stuff, this clutter that doesn't really matter. So investing a little bit more time up front so that you reduce a lot of that stuff on the back end can make it so everyone is just naturally more likely to be open to things like change just by putting in that little bit of time yourself. And yes, it's something that you have to change. Change is all about you. And it has nothing to do with you.
Yes. Well, and that all goes to, you know, so much of what I like to teach about, what I like to talk about around the customer experience, the employee experience, whatever experience you're delivering to somebody, there's opportunities for there to be friction throughout that experience. And that's either friction of actions that they need to take, or it's friction around how they may feel throughout that experience or the questions that they may have. And so it's just taking that extra time to say, okay, with what I'm communicating, what do I want them to do? what do I really want them to think? How do I want them to feel? And then what are some questions? What are some things that may be going on in their head as I'm delivering this? And how can I proactively answer those questions? How can I proactively address this friction before it even happens?
Yeah. There's a great book, Friction, by Roger Dooley, which he wrote the foreword of my first book, is awesome. There's also a book called Sludge. Nice. Yeah. I know, looking for the... Roger. Oh, that's Brain Fluence I see on the bottom there. So yeah, Roger's awesome. And there's another really great book called Sludge by Cass Sunstein, who co-authored the book Nudge that came out just at the end of last year. It's a really good one.
I haven't read that yet.
It's really, really good. And it's really short. So one where you can be looking at kind of what bogs us down. And I talk about sludge in my book. And in this, there are times where we want to alleviate and reduce the sludge, the friction, to make things easier. Yes.
Right.
And there is time where sludge can be a tactical advantage to work it in when we may be biased to move too fast. So if you are likely to send emails that are going to be problematic because you are busy, you know, I'm in a meeting, I'm going to send something really quick, that can cause problems down the line. Or if you get a little bit hot-headed and there could be problems and you need to take some time to be more thoughtful about it.
Yeah.
Having something where emails go into, you know, purgatory for a while and you have to review them before they can actually be sent, or putting in a reminder for yourself to follow up with somebody at a certain time, or you can't do this until you do that. Having that thoughtfulness can make it so that you're improving things down the line by slowing things down. Favorite example here would be of trying to get people to take the stairs instead of the elevator. Bringing it back to the literary example, we may think if we tell them about the benefits and why it's important that they're going to change their behavior, but we all know why we should take the stairs. That is not the problem, right? It's in that moment you go, oh, you know, I wanted to, but I'm running a little bit late, or I'm a little bit tired. I'm going to take the stairs next time, right? Tomorrow, I'm going to do that. That's our optimism bias and time discounting coming in. And so we think that we'll change, but that's the way that we're set up and we're always going to take the elevator. In this particular study, they slowed down the elevator doors by something ridiculous, like 26 seconds that it would take for the doors to open and then to close. It's a long time to wait for an elevator. And we are impatient in that way. Yeah. And then it becomes more convenient. The easier option is just, I'm just going to take the stairs. So they didn't tell anybody they did it. They just added this sludge of being slower in this process. People naturally change their behavior. And when they changed the doors back, it's not that people went back to taking the elevator. They had naturally shifted already and there was no reason to wait for the elevator. So again, a little thoughtful sludge can be valuable, but you want to put it in the right points for whatever problem you're trying to solve and make sure you know that you are leading people down those like small steps.
So we can put in that sludge and that friction into the current experience to make people more receptive to the change.
Sure. Yeah. That's something that's possible. Yeah.
Make it so bad that they want to change now.
Yeah. It depends. Yeah. Depending on the severity of that. Yes. But I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, and it all comes down to just being able to take the time to think it through and to think out how you're going to plan it, how you're going to be more intentional about understanding the people that the change itself is affecting, and then how you're communicating that change and how it affects them too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, last question before we wrap it up. If you were to create a 5-song soundtrack for what your employees need and can't tell you, what songs would you include?
All right. So I did think about this in advance, and I got just as I told you, you know, preemptively, I was going to like let them come to me. And the fifth one I just added to the list here. So I would say it is a mix that includes some great stuff. We've got Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles, because that's just Abbey Road is the greatest album of all time. So we got to put that in there. We have The Greatest by Sia. So like you can say like, I'm the greatest, right? As you're going into this and that you have the capacity to make a difference. But you also need to come as you are. Nirvana.
I'm from
the greater Seattle area here. So gotta give a nice little nod to them. We also have Defying Gravity, which is a song from the soundtrack of Wicked. Right. So, you know, you don't have to buy in on every change. You don't need to be going along with everything around you. It's okay to go kind of against the grain, just, you know, fight your own herding instincts in those ways. And ending it up with Happy by Pharrell. So you can be focusing on get happy. can be focusing on good stuff with our confirmation bias instead of some of the bad things, and everything can be a little bit smoother.
That's it. Yeah. And it's all around how you can make it smoother for yourself and smoother for others. Love it. Well, Melina, I have learned so much from your book and so much from talking with you today, but where can people go to learn more?
Oh, thank you. So you can just go to thebrainybusiness.com. It has information about my books and the podcast and all sorts of other ways to connect. So that's a great spot to go. You can also find me on pretty much all the socials as The Brainy Biz, B-I-Z.
Love it. Awesome. Well, Melina, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Melina Palmer. So go and visit her at thebrainybusiness.com. You'll get access to her books, her podcast, and all of her lessons to help you understand how to better communicate with your customers and your employees. And be sure and check out her latest book, What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You. Hey, it just released this week. It's going to help you reduce any friction when it comes to instilling organizational change and ensure that you can get your employees on board with any change in the simplest way possible. And if you're enjoying the Simple Brand podcast, go ahead and hit the subscribe button, because it's going to make it so much simpler for you to get future episodes like the next one featuring Rick DeLisi. Rick's an author and a speaker who helps companies achieve greater customer loyalty. And he's one of the co-authors of The Effortless Experience. Hey, that's considered one of the best customer experience books of all time. But Rick's back at it with his latest book, Digital Customer Service. Listen, the importance of crafting your customer experience centers around how you make your customer feel throughout every interaction. But in a digital-first world, you've got to make sure you invest in the right technology and the right technology processes to ensure that happens. So, delivering an outstanding customer experience today isn't just about the psychology, and it isn't just about the technology. It's about having the right marriage of psychology and technology baked into the experience. And Rick's lessons help you learn just how to do that so that you're always able to meet your customers where they are. So go ahead and subscribe. You'll automatically get Rick's episode as soon as it's live. Until then, keep it simple.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Simple Brand Podcast. Want to make your listening experience simple and automatically receive each new episode? Visit our website, simplebrandpodcast.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. If you're finding value from the Simple Brand Podcast, leave us a rating or review. That helps us get the show to the ears of the people who need it most. Be sure to catch Matt right here next week. Same Matt time, same Matt channel. Until then, keep it simple.